such thing of fear and misery. What is up, punks? It's Shinobi, and we are bringing you a special edition of Block Digest on December 18th with Mr. Peter Todd to discuss his opinion on how we should just raise the supply limit of Bitcoin because it's broken without a finite supply. So we're just going to put him on the spot right now and roast him over that.
glad to be on.
In all seriousness, though, this is going to be picking his brain about open timestamps and not arguing supply caps. But, you know, we
careful, because I'll seriously argue for them.
But we also have Janine with us, as usual, as well as Mr. Chris Ellis. So what's going on, guys?
Hey.
Did we lose a Janine?
I think we might have done.
Hello.
Hey.
Woo! So, what exactly is open timestamps, Peter? What's the point of it?
Well, I mean, the point of it's basically that the bad guys don't have time machines. And open timestamps let you prove things existed prior to some point in the past. And where that kind of, you know, is useful is essentially because very frequently you can rule out attacks by just showing that something was old enough.
Mm-hmm. And so pretty much, you know, to kind of give some context to this, you know, you made this back in, I want to say, 2015, 16. Is that right?
Yeah, the protocol that, you know, open time, like sort of the current version of open timestamps dates back from about 2016, if I remember correctly. Although I actually started the project way back in about 2012. I, you know, just kind of didn't have a need to go work on it for a while, and then I finally got around to actually, you know, getting it into sort of a production-ready version.
Do you have a timestamp to prove that?
I would, actually. I can go dig some up. Although, the interesting thing about that, of course, is that gets to what exactly do timestamps mean?
Well, I think real quick, you know, maybe we should touch on what the difference is between open timestamps and just naively peppering the entire blockchain with op return outputs for single things.
Well, in terms of what it actually proves, not that much of a difference. But in terms of how expensive it is, there's a very big difference. And, you know, I think the thing is to say, like, timestamping things with Bitcoin is a fair bit older than open timestamps. But what open timestamps really does is it makes it very, very cheap. You know, essentially, the only cost in open timestamps to do a timestamp is essentially, you know, the tiny bit of bandwidth. And the way it achieves that is through centralized infrastructure that just aggregates requests to timestamp things into gigantic Merkle trees. And the beauty of that, of course, is, well, Merkle tree can be as big as you want it to be.
Would you say it's a fair statement to say that if you aren't playing with Bitcoin UTXOs, there's no such thing as a block size?
Mostly, yeah. Well, in the case of open timestamps, yes. I could quibble about some other protocols, but certainly for open timestamps, I mean, you know, it really does scale as much as you want it. And just as an example, you know, I've personally timestamped with open timestamps in one Bitcoin transaction about 500 million documents once, which is when I, you know, had my project to go timestamp as much as possible of the Internet Archive.
But did you Merkleize it first, or did you individually timestamp each document?
Well, the thing is, with open timestamps, both those statements are the same.
Ah, right? Okay.
Because the, you know, the way the system works is essentially, you know, there's a couple different levels to it, but essentially, Merkle trees are getting built of every single thing anyone wants to timestamp in some period. And because a Merkle tree can be as big as you want it to be, well, that's what allows it to go scale.
Right, but other projects were reducing costs by batching files together using some proprietary, you know, software on the front end that the user interfaced with, but then on the back end it was timestamping lumps of documents. And the part of the problem with that is that, as you know, and you probably explain it better than I can, the sequence of the documents depends on, you know, the Merkle root depends on the sequence with which you hash those documents, right? So in order to get the Merkle root back again, you have to know the order in which the documents were hashed. And that's another data point that you need to remember.
Yeah. Well, like this, so, you know, part of the trade-off with open timestamps, and I think it's a very minor trade-off, compared to just using one UTXO per document, is that in open timestamps, you get an open timestamps proof. And that proof is a file containing, you know, essentially a series of mathematical operations, and those are followed in sequence to get to a Bitcoin block. Now, the proof is what allows it to go scale, because the data necessary for any individual document is contained in that proof. But it does mean, of course, you lose the proof. Well, you know, there goes your ability to go prove the document. But I mean, I wouldn't even call that much of a, you know, much of a problem, because after all, if you lose the document, you lose the ability to go prove it existed anyway. So, you know, you already got to go store something. Storing a very tiny, like 1K timestamp file isn't a big deal.
It can also be the version of the document, like a Word document, a user changes it without realizing that it would actually change the hash. I've seen that happen to people before.
Yeah. And that's why Open Timestamps has Git support built in, so that you can timestamp Git repositories, you know, as of a particular version.
Mm-hmm. And part of the whole way that you kind of solve like the scalability of this on the tech side, is kind of the division between the attestation server and the calendar servers that you run. So like kind of you want to like break down the thought process between kind of segregating those two different backend operations and how this kind of makes things a little more flexible in terms of a quick stamp proof and then the Merkle proof when it's confirmed and so on.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of pre-existing things, they had this problem where creating a timestamp wasn't a one-step operation. And, you know, why that matters is, well, I mean, Git's a great example, where if I want to timestamp a Git commit, I want to just add that timestamp to the commit itself, store it, and then I'm done. And then when I need to revalidate it, that might be, you know, 10 years down the road, you know, 5 years down the road. I mean, it's, you want this to be one step to create the timestamp, one step to go and validate it, if you ever do, many years later. And the issue with that is, well, Bitcoin transactions, of course, aren't instant. You know, it can take hours for a cheap Bitcoin transaction to go through. And, of course, I'm not going to pay a ton of money on the open timestamp servers, so they use very low fees. And what that means is you then have to have some sort of intermediate thing, because you want the process from request a timestamp to get a timestamp proof to complete in about a second. And the way Open Timestamps achieves that is with something called a calendar. And the idea with that is a calendar contains tips of Merkle trees that are sort of in a sense ephemeral. So the way that works is every second, it's batching up all the timestamp requests in that past second, creating a Merkle tree out of that, then storing the tip of that Merkle tree permanently, while then giving back timestamp proofs leading to that permanently stored tip. And then the second operation is that those tips of Merkle trees are then joined into bigger Merkle trees, and those get timestamped. So by being two steps, it lets you solve this latency issue while still eventually, you know, getting your timestamp back. And what this means is, well, the calendar server creates this calendar data structure, and anyone with a copy of that calendar data structure can validate all timestamps ever made using that server. So long story short, it essentially gets you the best of both worlds. And because the calendar data structure is fixed in size, or really it grows by a fixed amount per second, it's feasible for anyone to get a copy of that. You know, it's at most would ever be, you know, on the order of gigabytes.
Yeah, so it's kind of like rather than sit around and wait for the next block to come in, you just get a proof from the authority of the calendar server, which is periodically batched in. So you can get that right away and then just come back at some point and get the entire Merkle proof to the blockchain if you want to hold that locally instead of depend on this calendar server to verify things.
Yeah, although I'll point out, authority isn't quite the right word there, because calendar servers, the only thing that you're trusting them to do is to eventually perform that proof, and if you don't bother keeping a backup of that data yourself, to, you know, have a copy of that data around. But the moment you get a copy of that, you know, it has nothing to do with trust anymore. All the actual timestamping goes back to Bitcoin.
Or maybe notary would be a better term.
Well, I mean, I don't like the word notary either, because notary, in traditional sense, is a trusted service. And it also does a lot more than timestamping. You know, in the legal sense, most of what a notary does is actually to validate who is being, you know, who is doing something. You know, you can't just like give a notary a document and say, you know, put your stamp on it. The notary actually wants you to be there and interact with them in some way. Just, you know, validate, like, is this the person I, you know, whose signature is on there? You know, do they look like they were coerced? Things like that. You know, something that's actually, if anything, crypto really fundamentally can't do, because computer software can't tell whether or not you were coerced.
Well, then I'm going to have to take issue with the fact of you referring to Bitcoin as the notary in your original open timestamps write-up.
Yeah, well, I in 2012, I certainly got some terms wrong. And, you know, it's kind of unfortunate with a lot of this stuff, because the terminology does overlap things. It'd be nice if there was a term that was more clear. You know, and like in the open time sense protocol, I mean, I use the term notary to refer to the trusted things that actually perform that you know, timestamp. But I mean, let's face it, like, it's not a good term. I wish I could say otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be a stickler for terms in correct sense, then yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's in computer science, what do they say? The hardest things are off by one errors, and yeah, the three hardest things are name invalidation, like caching or something.
Yep. Alrighty. So, I think we've kind of broken down the core of the nuts and bolts under the hood. So, what exactly is a timestamp good for? And what is it not good for? Because there is a big shortcoming in open timestamps from where I'm standing that doesn't degrade its value, but makes it completely useless for an entire category of problems.
Yep, there absolutely is. And, you know, timestamping, I think, is one of these things where people think it's a lot stronger than it is. And the... I mean, probably one of the examples you see most often is people thinking you can usefully timestamp things like tweets, in that by itself, you know, being secure. And, you know, why that can be problematic is you got to remember, a timestamp is free. You know, because open timestamps is so scalable, you have this problem in certain applications where, since the timestamp is free...
Uh-oh, we lost to Peter.
Really wanted that little nugget there.
Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Bear with me while I try to get him back.
Yeah, no worries.
So, I mean, how fucked up is it that a Bitcoiner wants to raise the 21 million cap, though? Like, seriously. What the fuck?
Yeah, let's get into that at the end. Not...
All right, Peter, got you back.
All right. Sorry, where did I cut off there?
How things being very cheap makes lots of problems for some things.
All right, let me go over that again. So the irony with open timestamps is, because it's scalable and timestamps are effectively free, that actually makes them useless for applications where someone could go and just brute force all the possible things they might want to timestamp. A great example being like a stock prediction. You know, I want to be, I want to go prove how smart I am. So I go and predict that some stock will be some price in the future. But I prove that I was right by just timestamping my prediction. And then I just go and make in advance files predicting every single possible price. You know, in a situation like that, a timestamp really doesn't add any value because, you know, in advance, I can just timestamp every single possible thing. Another good example where timestamps don't add as much value as you might expect is when you're timestamping things that are inherently incriminating. You know, so suppose you want to go and show that some politician, you know, made some tweet and that tweet said something horrible. Well, at the moment when the tweet was created, it was obviously horrible. So you could have just faked that. You know, where a timestamp would add value is if at the creation, that tweet wasn't known to mean anything. Although even then, tweets are small, so you still might run into this brute forcing issue.
Mm-hmm. So it's effectively just this thing existed. It shows nothing about the correctness of something or the fact that there are no other conflicting statements. It does not address the double spend problem. Just
exactly
this exists.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And, you know, not addressing the double spend problem, that's kind of fundamental to the way it scales.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know how to start on how a attestation server, a calendar server would even begin to try to validate things like that with the different types of complex semantics of everything people would want to timestamp.
Yeah, and I'd say the advice I'd kind of give with open timestamps is because it's free, it's hard for it to make things worse. But you have to think carefully whether or not it actually made anything better.
So it sounds like the applicability of something like this is certainly useful for things like legal documents, for example, but perhaps slightly less useful for things that require context, like in journalism, where, you know, you can timestamp a particular tweet, but without the context, it perhaps isn't as relevant. You could sort of carve out your own narrative, if you like, you know, just with the timestamps.
I mean, I'm not even sure I would say that. I would more say, you know, in the case of some legal situations, the timestamp could be very useful. In other cases, it might not be. Same thing as I think with journalism. It really depends on exactly what the situation is and what exactly you timestamped. And also, I'd say, I mean, timestamps in many cases won't be the only form of proof. You know, it will be some proof in some context. You know, just to give a very simple cryptographic example, one of the very clear use cases for timestamps is timestamping digital signatures. And the reason why that's useful is because if a private key gets leaked later, if you can rule out, well, if you can say that the private key leaked only happened after some point in time, timestamps on signatures before that point in time let you still validate those signatures even after the compromise. You know, and Bitcoin Core, as itself, actually winds up using this because it, you know, many of the contributors use open timestamps to timestamp their Git commits and thus their PGP signatures on it. But you notice how you have to make that, you know, you have to kind of have this extra bit of context, right? The timestamp by itself didn't prove that the commit was real. Rather, it helped prove in conjunction with a digital signature that it was real. You know, it was one piece of evidence in that puzzle.
Mm-hmm. So pretty much you can layer on effectively identity layers in addition to the timestamps and use those as building more corroborating evidence for the truthfulness of something, which the timestamp can't do on its own.
Yeah, and I wouldn't just say it's always going to be identity layers, but certainly in the case of Git commits that are, you know, PGP signed, that's effectively an identity system.
Well, this kind of goes down a rabbit hole of many of the numerous things I think you could add on to open timestamps in terms of extensions. Like, with the current architecture now, you've already effectively split the actual blockchain attestation and the more granular calendar attestations into different functions and different services. I mean, could you not do a similar thing in terms of reputation-based notaries?
Let me go point out a technical note, by the way. In the actual implementation right now, the calendars and the aggregation are actually the same server, but they can easily be separated. And there is one implementation that does actually separate them, but that's not actually the one that runs. But
the point I'm making, though, is like the abstract separation of functions. Like, you could extend another one with identity-based notaries that are actually signing off on the validity of the contents they're verifying with some means of validation, and actually kind of have those identity-based notaries attach their own subtrees to the greater opens timestamp tree, and kind of create a structured silo under that, where you can attempt to, within some trust model, deal with double spend or verification issues just based on the identity of that notary.
Well, so the way I'd put it is, the moment you have some kind of attestation to validity, then I think the right approach to that is really approach it as as its own thing. And when appropriate, use timestamp proofs, as a part of that, rather than, what I'm trying to say is, the way you're describing that is as though that kind of sits underneath open timestamps, when really those kind of systems that have some kind of notion of validity, they tend to be things that really have to be developed separately as their own system. And the timestamping part of that would just be, some module that kind of plugs in. But in terms of just double spends, another project of mine, ProofMarshall, is attempting to, among other things, create a way of preventing double spends that is kind of general, in the sense that what the primitive ProofMarshall wants to give you is something I'm calling a single-use seal, which is similar to a cryptographic pub key, private key pair, but with a single-use seal, it has this sort of magical, non-mathematical property that you can't sign twice, or the terminology of called a seal, you can't close the seal twice. And obviously, this can't be done with math alone, but notice how Bitcoin transaction can only be spent once. So Bitcoin transaction output can be used to implement a single-use seal.
I was actually going to ask you if that was related to one-use seals, because I have never heard that term ProofMarshall before.
Yeah, well, it's my rather incomplete and slow-moving project, but what I'm aiming to do is essentially create a library to let you build data structures that work well with these kind of use cases. And the single-use seal concept, that's sort of one of the things that I want Marshall to support well. And where you would wind up using that is, for example, to create attestation chains or things like that. Suppose, for instance, in one of your notary examples, your true notary examples, who goes and attests to the validity of something, you might want to be able to go and provide proof that here is a full set of things they've attested to let other people audit, did you ever attest to anything that was false? And that full set, you could then implement that with single-use seals, so that you kind of start off with one, one seal and create a chain of them. And then anyone can go and validate by sort of validating every step in that chain, the fact that they have the full set of that data.
Actually, would you mind breaking down for the listeners, and I'm not going to lie myself, the mechanics of how a one-use seal works? It's actually been quite a while since I watched your presentation on that, and I'm kind of blanking on the mechanics.
Yeah, so the sort of API side of it, the sort of abstraction side of it, is you have this uniquely identifiable seal, and you can close that seal over a message exactly once, producing a witness to the fact that it was closed. And if the seal protocol is secure, then closing that seal should only be able to happen once, and the message should be uniquely at a particular transaction output.
Yeah, shit. I hate to cut you off, Peter, but we're kind of having lag issues.
Oh. All right. Let me, here, where did I cut off?
Maybe 15, 20 seconds ago, talking about the API structure. All right. Voice check.
All right. Can you hear me?
All right. One, loud two, and clear. Three. We lost you around the statement API structure.
Yeah. So the API abstraction of a single-use seal is effectively, you have something called a seal, and it's uniquely identifiable. And you can close the seal over a message. Now, when you close it over a message, you get a witness, which is just another bit of data attesting to the fact that a particular seal was closed over a particular message. And if a single-use seal protocol, or really, I should say, implementation is secure, that operation should be able to happen exactly once, you know, not twice. Now, to get a little less abstract, well, how would you actually implement this? The simplest way is to say that a particular Bitcoin transaction output is a seal, and your witness is just a transaction spending that output with an op return output designating, you know, the hash of the message that it was closed over. And since a Bitcoin transaction output can only be spent once, that single-use seal protocol is secure.
All right. And now how does this tag into using open timestamps as a verification mechanism for that?
Well, you know, it really doesn't, because open timestamps fundamentally can't prove that thing. But, you know, where they're kind of related is, I think, in sort of a more abstract sense of just the fact that, you know, we're going back to Bitcoin to go and implement these things. And maybe the other bit of relation is, well, an obvious question there is, how do you make a single-use seal protocol efficient? Because obviously, if it's just one Bitcoin transaction output per seal, you're going to need a lot of Bitcoin transaction outputs. But to scale single-use seals, we can actually, again, use Merkle trees, although in a different fashion. See, open timestamps uses a Merkle tree from bottom up, if you will. That is, open timestamp proof starts at the very bottom of a Merkle tree and then works its way upwards. Whereas to scale single-use seals, you actually want to work from the top down. And the way you do that is say, well, rather than have a seal be directly Bitcoin transaction output, what if it's proof that a signature for a particular pub key wasn't published in some data structure? And if that data structure consists of a linear chain of Merkle trees indexed by, you know, pub key, then you can verify without having the full set of data that a particular pub key doesn't have a valid signature, followed by then having a valid signature, extracting all of the parts of those Merkle trees corresponding to that particular pub key.
So pretty much a canonically ordered Merkle tree rather than just a rolling disorganized one like open timestamps.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, because in the open timestamps proofs, you know, that proof format doesn't actually know Merkle trees exist. I mean, it doesn't even know Bitcoin transactions exist. It just blindly follows a sequence of operations. And those operations may or may not actually be a Merkle tree. But if you constrain it much, much more rigidly, then you have something which, you know, really forces a single path in a particular way down Merkle trees. And then that's what allows you to constrain it tightly enough that double spends are impossible.
So random left turn here. Are you aware of the mainstay protocol that Commerce Block created?
The name sounds familiar, but I mean, there's been so many of these kind of protocols, so I don't remember the exact detail of that one.
It's pretty much the idea of having a infinitely sized Merkle tree timestamped in a transaction just like open timestamp. But the difference is in mainstay, you kind of have a sort of consensus rule to the transaction committing to the timestamps. And that's that it has to move forward linearly with no more than a single output. So you can add new inputs, but any instance of a transaction in the chain with more than one output invalidates the everything that it's committing to. And then the structure of the Merkle tree is actually canonically organized so that people can effectively purchase slots that you can have inclusion proofs for, on both sides, so you can see to some degree that nothing conflicting was committed to under this slot, and effectively guarantee, for each slot that's registered with this transaction chain, that there is only one state, one commitment to any sub branch of the tree, and kind of pretty much in my mind, it's just restructuring open timestamps to be able to address the double spend problem.
I would disagree with that statement. And the reason is I would not, like what you described as a timestamp transaction, I would not call a timestamp. The moment you're kind of putting those kind of rules on it, I don't think the term timestamp's a good one. I would actually say that they're pretty, what they've done is pretty close to a single use seal. And yes, I mean, everything you just described there makes total sense. I think the single use seal concept has advantages with flexibility and whatnot. In terms of security, implemented properly, they should be absolutely identical. And also implemented properly, mainstay certainly should scale. It's probably going to be a little less convenient for certain types of applications, but these are kind of low-level tech details, not like fundamental issues.
Well, that's kind of where, looking at the two things together, goes in my mind. I mean, what reason is there that you couldn't, say, operate a mainstay implementation that has a designated slot to take unordered open timestamps type commitments for that one slot and commit to that as well as canonically ordered enforced subtrees in the same transaction?
Well, I mean, the thing with open timestamps is because the proof format is general, there is absolutely no technical reason why I couldn't go write a, calendar server that actually did that to background. That would just be a money-saving thing. The disadvantage would be the proofs would be a little bit bigger, but, from a validity point of view, the open timestamps clients wouldn't even know. So it's just, I guess, I would say that considerations like that are really implementation details, precisely because open timestamps doesn't have the notions of validity that make any of that actually relevant. Similarly, in actual open timestamps implementation I've changed the transaction format multiple times just to, save a little bit more money on transaction fees. Again, the clients don't care. The proof format has no idea what a transaction is. So exactly how you get the timestamps is really not very relevant.
I mean, from the point of view of auditability, but, I don't know. Ever since you've published the original write-up on open timestamps, Peter, I have been obsessed with the concept of this as a protocol. And it boggles my mind that, it's almost just glossed over everywhere in the space. The potential of open timestamps as just an extension of Bitcoin is, in my mind, this could just be a new protocol or suite of protocols on the internet, like HTTP, like FTP. The usefulness, as long as you understand the limitations and what they can and cannot do, it is enormous. But it's still just such a niche thing as far as what people talk about and look at in this space.
Well, I think the reason why that that's the case is because actual security that actually works isn't necessarily all that glamorous and doesn't necessarily make people a lot of money. You know, open timestamps is great because it's essentially free, actually scales, you know, doesn't require a token, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, none of these things are good for hyping up your company to go sell your, you know, latest ICO token.
Eh, touche. But I mean, there's just so much stuff you can build. I mean, you know, kind of. Let's take a shift here, and we can talk about fun stuff like that. But you know, the first idea that has popped into my head has always been a decentralized internet archive. And I'm gonna get a little tinfoily down a little side hole here for a second. But if you're familiar with the plugin TLS Notary that broke, I think, in the last few years, that used to actually allow you to play games in the web browser API and feed the site itself as part of the TLS handshake to get a signature on that that could be used to timestamp. And if you put all of these things together, you could just have a decentralized provable internet archive. I could have gotten the TLS signature, timestamped that, saved the timestamp with a local copy of the website, but all the web browsers out there broke the API that lets you play with the TLS handshake at that low of a level.
Well, and also, I mean, they may have come up with a way to fix this issue, but as I recall, TLS Notary actually did require a trusted third party. The trusted third party didn't need to actually see the data, but you know, essentially due to the way the crypto worked, the trusted third party had to be trusted to perform some mathematical operation in the TLS handshake to actually make any of this work.
But you could effectively replace that, since that's been broken, with you know, an authority like Internet Archive. If they had an identity key to sign off on things that were archived with them, and then a local copy was downloaded, like effectively with a similar trust model, you can do the same kind of thing.
Well, so I guess what I'm trying to say is the difference is, ideally, we want to fully decentralize things where websites actually sign their content. But since we can't quite do that, we'll have to have a centralized but distributed model. And, you know, long story short, though, is I certainly agree with you that it would be nice to have a web archiver that, rather than just store it on a web page, actually gives you a signed bit of data, you know, signed archive. Indeed, I probably could do that for timestamps and just have, you know, have as part of that project a trusted server that just gives you back it could even just be a PHP signature on a work archive with a timestamp. So if the PHP key gets leaked, you can still validate it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because it's like that is a piece of internet infrastructure, in air quotes, because it ultimately is just a service that has become very important, at least to people trying to sift around and get through whitewashing in things. But like, you know, we've seen over the last few years, like there are instances where the archive disappears or the DMCA request makes it go poof. And that kind of brings into question the utility there.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, after all, I was involved in a rather expensive lawsuit where archived web pages, in particular tweets, were a very big issue. And sure enough, you know, at times, like the Internet Archive just disappeared thousands of them. And it's not really clear to me what actually happened. Is that a technical mistake? Is that because, you know, the person I was suing had friends there? I really don't know. You know, that's exactly the case where at least a distributed model where you can download a backup that you can then, you know, validate later is really, really valuable. And as far as I know, nothing offers this, you know, absolutely nothing. There's quite a lot of archiving services out there, but none of them, as far as I know, will actually put a signature on a file that you can download.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this, as I recall, from the TLS Notary project, was an issue with the banks, right? Because in theory, you could download a copy of your online bank statement and get the signature and timestamp it, but the banks themselves would never allow that to be any kind of authorization on their part.
Yeah, and I've independently heard the same thing where, you know, they really do not want to create third-party verifiable proof like that. You know, they always want there to be some ambiguity. And indeed, I've heard the same thing about, you know, sort of crypto coin projects, like centralized crypto coins. You know, I've heard even like regulators complaining that they really don't want this auditability to exist because they want the ability to go change things without people being able to know or, you know, being able to prove it. And there's a lot of kind of conflicts there with the cryptographic reality.
That's actually something I never heard. I kind of just thought it was just an innocuous take this away, and there wasn't any particular reason behind it.
That makes sense. I've been to a lot of conferences with people who might not show up at Bitcoin conferences. And, you know, especially a couple of years ago, like talking to some of these sort of regulatory and banking types was quite eye-opening, you know, the way some, you know, and I shouldn't say all of them thought, but there's certainly a minority who see this stuff as a real threat to their ability to go do things, you know, and I think also like some of it isn't necessarily coming from sort of an evil place, if you will. I mean, some of it's sort of coming from the realities of certain legal jurisdictions where they, you know, courts just expect to be able to do things like say, well, just arbitrarily change that, you know, like don't tell anyone that you've arbitrarily changed that. You know, it's like kind of like publication bans where, I mean, my country Canada is an example where courts see fit to just order people to go and never publish certain things.
Yeah, I think that is a nice transition to another use case of open timestamps that's pretty fleshed out. Janine.
Hello.
Hey. Right.
A lot of fake news being circulated. A lot of ninja editing in the media these days, isn't there?
Well, I mean, speaking of, weirdly enough, people who don't want tools like this to exist, I think that, I mean, I don't know how many, because I don't think a lot of them have looked at it yet, but I think, I get the sense that there's a lot of journalists who don't want verifiability either. They don't want to use it themselves, because that would expose them if used it, and they would have to be extremely careful not to expose themselves in some way using it, whether that's open timestamps or Git or anything that, you know, kind of gives some accountability. But I also feel like they don't want it to exist in general, because if other journalists use it, then, you know, that makes them look at least a bit more honest. You know, they've put in the work to make something verifiable, whereas they're not. So I haven't really heard that, but I feel like that's part of the lack of interest.
I think in terms of sort of verifiability in journalism, all you really need to know is that the vast majority of journalists don't cite what they're talking about in their articles.
Like, yes.
Right there, that tells you immediately they have no desire to actually have verifiability. You know, if they're not even willing to cite basic things like, well, what medical study are you actually talking about? You know, what tweet are you actually talking about? You really have no commitment to this kind of accuracy and transparency to even begin with.
Yeah, part of the presentation that I was supposed to give Monday that didn't end up happening, one of the slides was, weirdly enough, a screenshot of a blog post in the Scientific American, which is weird enough that Scientific American has a blog. But the article was about how to find studies and journals that news organizations mentioned in their articles but didn't ever link to or really cite at all properly. And yeah, that's the reason that I started doing what I do, is because I was so angry that I don't think it was even just laziness. As it says in that article that I cited, a lot of media have a policy of not linking to sources for whatever reason, either because they don't want to lose traffic to other websites or strangely enough, because they're afraid that if people actually look at their sources and see how bad they are in some cases, that they, you know, they'll lose credibility, which is an interesting fear to me.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think the just losing traffic by people clicking out is part of it. But, you know, as I've kind of looked into journalism more and actually, like, sort of, if you will, reverse engineered those citations myself, you know, I absolutely believe it's, I guess the way you could kind of describe it is this sort of kind of lazy fraud that I think a lot of journalism has gotten into, where they knowingly lie to people. Not so much because they have any particular agenda, but rather because that's just a lot cheaper and a lot more effective. You know, if you're always willing to twist the truth to get a better story, that'll get more clicks. And you have a culture where, you know, because of competition, where that kind of becomes acceptable. Well, you're going to have a lot of measures to make that easier to get away with.
Yeah, the culture's a key part of this, right? It's the fact that people are just trusting these publications rather blindly and are not actually themselves following links. And there isn't a big enough community right now of fact-checkers because, you know, you need to fact-check fact-checkers. I understand that there are companies, often we don't know who they are. We know that Twitter claims to outsource to a bunch of fact-checking companies, but then who's holding those to account?
Although, a point I would make with that is I don't think this is so, you know, I don't think you can quite so easily just say, you know, this is people trusting this stuff. I think what's actually, you know, a better description of this is journalism has just shot itself in the foot because people don't trust it anymore on a wide scale.
Well, that's happening. Yes, I agree that is a transition. And in a way, you know, as somebody who reads a lot of philosophy, I sort of see that the latest trend, like fake news, is really just a democratization of Cartesian doubt. I mean, they're finally catching up with an idea that a French dude had a few hundred years ago that set philosophy into a little tailspin as like philosophers went around in circles saying, oh shit, we can't disprove this. We can't invalidate cogito. And what on earth are we going to do if we don't know that the world is real? I mean, eventually, philosophy as an industry kind of acquiesced and it just sort of quietened down in the mid sort of 20th, late 20th century. And now everyone's obsessed with consciousness, but now the public have caught up with the idea that, well, what can I really know? And but you still are seeing like these fringe communities. You end up with like this extremism because they're not professional philosophers, they're not trained in logic or reasoning. They end up going down these stupid rabbit holes and they think that the world is flat because, you know, you can't disprove it. You end up wasting a lot of your time. And actually the energy I would say that needs to be spent is actually validating the claims that are made in these publications, and that's part of the culture I think that is missing.
Well, though maybe where I disagree there is validation's all well and good, but getting that validation to mean anything's really hard because you're up against a public who part of them do in fact, you know, trust journalism, but I think they sort of trust journalism because they want to, not so much because they actually have reason to.
Yeah.
And then I'd say another part has such severe mistrust, it's very hard to kind of build up trust in any way. And between those two, between those phenomenon, you know, what is your validation going to do to media organizations who make their money essentially selling clicks to people who want to believe? It's really hard to kind of make a dent in that because it's also broken to begin with. You know, I think where this has the most benefit is in converting more people from the side of want to believe to actually thinking for themselves a bit and realizing how, you know, how much of a lie all this stuff is.
Right.
But that's kind of a slow process, and there's a limit to how far you can go because there are a lot of people who want to believe.
Right, you've hit it on the head, yeah. It's that people read the publications that they want to believe. Like in the UK, we have Daily Mail readers, right? They read the Daily Mail and they choose to believe it because it suits them. It suits whatever agenda that they were already invested in.
In one of the real ironies, I think, with that is on some topics, the Daily Mail has been doing really great reporting precisely because their audience wants to believe certain things. And in certain cases, reporting stuff accurately actually goes and fits, you know, that kind of narrative that, you know, those people want to see.
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested to hear more from Janine about like what she thinks that how your particular tool can be used in journalism today. And I'm also interested in particular to know how much of an issue is the tracking of the version of the authoring of the document, because I don't know in mainstream media how often it is an issue that a publication changed some wording on a website without notifying people. I know that CoinDesk has been guilty of that, and these kind of amateurish kind of crypto publications have been a bit shady in that way. But why is, Janine, the tracking of the version of the authoring of the document actually important?
Well, there's a few things. Because at the moment, I mean, unless you're on GitHub and you're watching the repository, you don't really get notifications. And those notifications are kind of not as useful because you're getting notified every time I make a change, and that might not necessarily be a meaningful change. It might be just me fixing a punctuation error or something. And so I think the notification part is still that's like still a work in progress. That's actually something that was mentioned in one of the books I used for research was Trust Me, I'm Lying. And the reason I like it is because it's written by a media strategist, and most of the book is about how he exploited the media and kind of their biases in order to, you know, promote stories that would make him money, to promote people that were paying him, etc. But it's also about how the media was exploiting their readers. And so when journalists are looking at my model and saying, like, how does this fix trust? Like, I have to keep telling them it doesn't. Like, it's a tool and it helps you appear more trustworthy. That doesn't mean you are trustworthy. Like, being trustworthy is a relationship. It's not a button that you can just press. I would say that the biggest value of the versioning, at least from my perspective and the authors, is more to do with being able to transparently see who contributes to story, which you very rarely get. The markup has been doing more of that. Obviously, they're not doing anything with Git or like any proofs of any kind with signatures, but they at least have a credit section where they're listing off everyone who is contributing, whether it's just the byline author or the person who did fact-checking, or if there's a video, they helped produce the video. They're giving credit to everyone involved, and I think that's a good step in the right direction. With my investigations, well, some of it is a bit weird because, you know, there have been people who've created GitHub accounts just to, I think, make a commit, a pull request to my repo, and then they delete their account later. So that doesn't help too much. All you can really see is that, you know, this defunct account made a change, whatever the name of it was. So that's not as helpful, but I think there haven't been too many people who've made direct changes. Most of them have opened issues, so I think the authoring more has to do with going more in the direction of journalism, trying to actually give credit to people who do work on a piece.
And also, what about, because you're using Peter Todd's tool, right, for your investigations? I mean, you mentioned that maybe we should put a link in the description to your Git repo.
Well, this isn't about me, but yes, Peter has made.
Yeah, but it's a use case. Stamps. I mean, it's a use case. So, I mean, we can riff around that, right?
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing with Jeannie's particular repo is that it's effectively timestamped by GitHub every time she makes a commit. Because the usual way I know you make commits is through the GitHub interface, which GitHub actually is PHP key signed. So what I was mainly doing with the open timestamps that I've added to that repo was to rule out this future compromise scenario where if, you know, GitHub leaks their keys or they get compromised or something, you know, it's to be good to be able to verify those signatures.
Mm-hmm. I think that is a huge useful case for this in pretty much every realm, like journalism, interactions, so on and so forth. certain emails that we can't mention without getting our YouTube channel in trouble.
But I think it also the one of the values of verifying and doing the version control on the authoring of the document is that it makes it a lot easier for fact checkers to come in and see the provenance of the data and the evidence that was used. In fact, in philosophy and in media studies, there's a term, I think it's called leveling. Leveling is what news anchors do when they give you a story, but they don't explain to you, like they might say, a particular militia in this particular rogue, you know, state. And they'll talk about it as if they've always understood the local politics there. They talk to you as if they're experts in it, when actually that they may have only just learned it themselves, for example. That's called leveling. And I think one of the sort of potentials for this sort of form of, let's say, version control or scientific journalism, perhaps we could call it, is that anyone could be a fact checker. All you really need to be is motivated and diligent. You just need to go through the versions of the document. You can say, okay, they used this piece of evidence here, or that it was deleted in this version, but I can see how they arrived at these conclusions. And perhaps it could be, you know, used in that way.
And it's interesting how there's sort of this perception that fact-checking has been this very professional thing, when in reality, you know, most of it's just looking up some really basic sources and just seeing what contradicts each other. It really tends not to be very difficult. But,
right,
you know, without that kind of evidence trail and the citation trail and so on, it becomes a lot of work that doesn't really need to exist.
Yeah. I think in that line, I find the versioning to be useful in terms of, you know, anyone who wants to see what it looked like at any prior stage in time can just go back, and it's not a great proof of like, oh, this is what the author knew at the time, because it's possible that I, you know, held on to things and didn't add them until later, until it was relevant. But I mean, you kind of get that when the time of the commit is very close to the date that something was archived, for example, that can sort of show that kind of in a soft way. But I like the fact that anyone can go back and see what it looked like at a prior stage in time, just to know, like, this was the information that people could have had at the time if they had had this investigation.
I think that's really useful, though, in a way, like Chris is nailing on the head, just in terms of for normal people who don't usually dig into or verify anything. Like, I pay very close attention to politics, and most of my history with my family are people just going, oh, but what's the source here? And then the mountain of work existing for me to go find that, to show them something, to get them to take something seriously. If all of that is already there, like, it's not just me as the person fact-checking who's benefiting from that. It's all the other people who immediately demand, like, where's the source that I can just go grab and throw in their hands too. Like, you know what I mean? I think you're kind of underselling the potential usefulness there, Janine.
Well, a point I'd make with versioning is I think one of the places where it really shows more values, ironically, in the less well-cited journalism, you know, such as, say, you know, like the New York Times or something, because it lets you so easily see how accurate articles actually are. But then the irony of that is I think what we're seeing is they're realizing they really can get away with just changing things on the fly, because the audience who they're selling clicks to doesn't really seem to care.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's good for the higher standard, but where it really works is, ironically, the types of journalism that have such low standards to begin with.
Yeah, that was when I had an impromptu Jitsi meetup after the talk didn't work out. That was one of the questions I got, was, you know, what if a journalist doesn't want to use version control throughout the entire time that they're writing their investigation, either because they're afraid of, you know, including something at an early stage that they then want to remove later that's, you know, really sensitive. Maybe it's a source name who decides they don't want their name to be public, something like that. And, you know, I said, it's perfectly fine for someone to not use this model all the way through. The original inspiration for it was to at least do it from the point that you publish, so that if you make changes after the fact, then that is at least visible, because that's what most people are concerned about, is that they read an article, it comes out, it's breaking news, and then they change it later after they've made a mistake. And it's good that they're making corrections for mistakes, but then it's hard to trace back where the error originally spread from if the article that started it is now not the same anymore.
Not to mention, from a tech point of view, nothing stops you from simultaneously having version control and the ability to permanently delete things. If you have a version controlled document that the technology allows you to permanently delete things, all that means is the version control will just say, yes, there was this version and this part of that version is being deleted permanently. And, you know, there's no longer a way to get a copy of that. Equally, if you publish anything at all, obviously people will be able to go and archive it and get a copy of it later. That's just reality.
Yeah, that has been the case with the archive services. And I think that's been the, you know, primitive way that readers have been able to hold media to account when they've made changes, as if someone happened to grab it at that point in time before they made the change. But yeah, it would be better if it was embedded in the actual piece and it wasn't readers having to chase down an archived copy, because, like, unless you know how to use those, I mean, I'm pretty familiar with it, but I've come across a lot of people that they don't even know how to archive something, because the website has become, I think, a bit more complicated. There's like several more steps now to actually archive a page. I don't know if that's deliberate or just some part of their flow that they disrupted, but I feel like a lot of people, even if you have that, they don't actually know how to use it properly.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, archives are like that are amazing, because there's been so many times where I think it's just interesting. I was actually more excited when I found the Internet Archive than I was finding Bitcoin.
Wow.
Because I was like, oh wow, wait, so you can see prior versions of websites, you can see websites that have been, you know, deleted. That's great. I can read someone's old blog that they thought was gone from the internet. That's pretty good.
Nice.
Well, I mean, it's a really like crazy thing. But like, you know, I think like all the topics like we've been touching on as far as the usefulness of these types of tools with journalism and publications. I mean, like, just to kind of broaden the topic a bit, like, think through applying this to legal documents, to public records, to any kind of authoritative decision made in the public aspect of life. Like, these can bubble out so much further than just journalism.
Well, it's interesting. Apparently, there is actually a big problem in legal records, and I don't just mean, you know, like legal cases, but like official legal texts and legal rulings and stuff, where there are a lot of modifications made after the fact for things that should be just grammatical and other minor errors. But, you know, fairly often they turn out to actually have pretty serious repercussions, because they've changed things that actually affect the substance of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how they just don't put it on a Git repo, at least.
Well, I mean, it's just all these little niche things, like, you make a lot of good points about incentives to not use tools like this in some, you know, fields or aspects of society. But I really feel like it's inevitable in all of them that the pressure from the mob, so to say, just keeps building up to use this. I mean, you know, like I said earlier in the show, that there is just so much potential with extending open timestamps or timestamps in general to so many different use cases. How the hell does this not eventually just become an important protocol in the internet stack?
Well, it's interesting how with a bunch of the data being collected with COVID, people have been using Git, which, you know, may not have the same cryptographic guarantees as open timestamps. But even that's a huge improvement over the traditional ways of doing things.
Mm-hmm. It, I mean, that is a perfect example. Like, there have been a lot of material policy changes made based on data that usually start finding a lot of problems with.
Yep.
So, Peter, I think it's time, man.
Well, it's time for me to finally get proof marshal shipped.
Time to defend your attack on the supply of Bitcoin.
Oh, that's easy. Because Bitcoin security right now is, partially based on inflation. So why would you want to go change a thing that's obviously working?
Because it doesn't guarantee censorship resistance.
A bit of inflation won't hurt anyone. You know, 0.5% inflation, that's approximately zero anyway.
Yeah, but if you have, you know, a permanent subsidy that miners can latch onto, then the fee guarantees, creating censorship-resistant incentive alignment there, it starts falling apart.
Yeah, but if it doesn't fall apart, then that's all well and good. And if it does fall apart, wouldn't you really rather have an inflation subsidy to go make Bitcoin still somewhat work? Like, in no incentive will the inflation subsidy make the fees subsidy fall apart. You know, you'll always be able to go pay fees. You'd rather watch it die. Maybe we should crowdfund some Bitcoin donations for you so you have more incentive to keep it working.
Did you just try to bribe me to support increasing the supply? Despicable. That was absolutely despicable, Peter. I don't think I can continue respecting you anymore.
Oh, even worse. I want to go bribe miners to get them to continue mining Bitcoin.
I just don't know who I'm talking to anymore.
Well, how do you know? I mean, it's not like this conversation is cryptographically signed. You could be talking to some GPT-2 bot with good voice synthesizer.
That's what people say about me.
Oh, I know you're not real. I mean, I've met you. You're definitely not real.
Bitcoin has been infiltrated by Skynet.
Speaking of which, I have this silly idea coming up called 12 Days of J9 where I tweet out pictures of fake women from thispersondoesnotexist.com.
Nice.
To confuse the algorithm, because I feel like it.
Speaking of, have you seen the site This Person Does Exist?
No, but I feel like that's related to the, what is it called? Clover or something? Clearview.
Well, so This Person Doesn't Exist is, of course, AI-generated ones. This Person Does Exist just republishes all the faces used in the datasets to train the AI.
Ah.
That's creepy.
It kind of is.
I mean, because some of them can get, like, really weird. My favorite one is the one where it looks like she has a nose ring. I've actually used it in a few places, but one of my favorites is one where it looks like she has a nose ring, but actually it's just a glitch around her nostril. Was just the perfect glitch, and it looks like a nose ring.
Yeah, for at least now, we still have the advantage that these AIs don't really understand physics.
Yeah. Ah, man. The whole class of things that are not fixed with time stamping when deep fakes run amok.
Yep.
You can definitely tell that it's been trained on human faces a lot more than other things, because the variations of, like, this cat does not exist, this horse does not exist, those are very, like, the quality's pretty low on most of those.
Yeah.
Ironically, this whole class of stuff is why I think it's so damn important to really start baking open timestamps into things now, while we can start making anchor points where everybody can't just go deepfake, 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 deepfake.
Well, I mean, that should be the new tagline for open timestamps. Reality anchor.
I'm already thinking of memes to pun your reality anchor.
Well, I should make that the commercial. The Open Timestamps logo is, of course, is a stylized clock, and the Proof Marshall logo should be a big anchor.
I mean, I'm excited to hear that you're actually working on something with that, man. Like, that talk when I first watched it was damn fascinating, and then in usual fashion, you just kept talking about things.
Yeah.
Alrighty. So I'm pretty much plumb out of substantial things to talk about. How are you feeling, Peter and Janine?
Well, this got a bit over the hour I allocated, so I got ahead. But
I'm going to cut out the argument about the supply cap, Peter, and I'm going to shame you on Twitter for a day or two before I publish the full interview.
Shinobi, nice. We don't cut things.
We should break the timestamp proof. Yeah. Hell, maybe I'm recording this and I'm going to go shade you by cutting stuff.
Well, game on.
Well, next time we should talk about forensics, because I am interested in, like, you know, live broadcast, you know, sequential timestamping. I used to work in the film business, and there are lots of ways that you could prove the validity of a sequence of frames. So that's a rabbit hole. I didn't take us down it today, but it is an interesting topic.
Well, you get interesting stuff like, you know, validating a 60 hertz hum, for instance.
Right.
You know, making sure that it's actually there and in the right phase and so on.
Yeah.
That would actually be an interesting hole to go down to, if I can twist your arm to come back later, Peter.
Well, I used to analog electronics design, so in fact, like, one of my first things I want to do with open timestamps was to timestamp recordings of 60 hertz hum.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you might need to get out more, but yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I grok you.
We all need to get out more.
The neat thing with it is, if you have a good recording of it, it then makes it easy to do signal processing later to then go and better fake an audio recording.
Yeah, I find it fascinating, and I think that it has not yet been realized. Like, engineers haven't yet realized the potential of that, and how, you know, why that might be useful. I mean, CCD arrays and the CMOS sensors have their own signature. You know, you can look, you download a digital image, as long as it hasn't been compressed too much, you can actually say specifically which camera that came from, so long as you have the pattern that the CMOS had when it was first manufactured.
Yep. Yeah, one of the few ways around that, essentially, use the highest resolution video camera you can get, and then downsample it.
Yeah.
Yep, this is definitely a rabbit hole. That is,
yeah,
for sure.
So that's why I didn't want to talk about it on the actual show proper, but yeah.
But maybe another episode.
For sure.
Well, alrighty.
Cool. Should we do our goodbyes, or what do you want to do?
Yeah, I guess it is time for the outro. Hope it was interesting. Hope it was enjoyable. Catch you later, punks.
Alright, thank you.
Bye.
Hele aller stanse i min løyd. Måsner, det seng et kjøsens rød. Ikke jeg fortsatt rett i siden. Jeg snitt i de søkmer, ja.